Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Inside Education is the programme that brings you insights into teaching, learning and all aspects of education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney and you can listen to or download podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education on insideed.com. Stephen Murgatroyd is an expert on innovation policy and practice, and he takes a particular interest in education. I met up with him earlier this year at the Enerdelm conference in Malahide. Although he lives today in Alberta, Canada, he was born in Yorkshire in England, and on graduating from University College Cardiff, he became a special needs teacher in Wales. He knows Ireland well, having spent time at the Education Centre in Drumcondra. He completed postgraduate degrees from the Open University and he became Dean at Athabasca University in Canada and developed the world's first online MBA programme. Today, he is CEO of the Collaborative Media Group, which helps clients solve problems using technology. One area that Stephen Murgatroyd has written about is what he calls Renaissance leadership. So when I spoke to him, I first asked him to tell me what he means by Renaissance leadership.
I'm a futurist. And, you know, the old lines, the future isn't what it used to be. And we have to start rethinking how we think and feel about education in order to get to the next phase of development. And most of what's going on in Europe is extremely worrying. I mean, especially in the UK, which is a travesty of what public education should be like. And this preoccupation with PISA and all these results are just ridiculous. So we have to start thinking differently about what the purpose of education is. So the Renaissance kind of focus is going back and saying, so what was one of the better periods in European history? It was a period of great transformation and change where substantial values changed, and where leadership became very different. We're no longer hierarchical, much flatter, more engaging kind of processes, so that intellectual scholarship and respect for professions grew. What's happening right now with this global education reform movement is a deprofessionalization of education, a preoccupation with markets and private mechanisms, a preoccupization with test results, which are largely meaningless. And what I'm trying to do and what my colleagues are trying to do is saying, let's focus back on why we're doing all this, which is about building responsible citizenship, which is part of a Renaissance thinking. Let's talk about the whole person, not just their competences and behaviors, part of Renaissance thinking. Let's talk about the emotional well-being and the emotional intelligence of children, not just skills and behaviors. And let's not just focus on economic needs, but on the total needs of community and society. So we're saying there needs to be a new Renaissance, there needs to be an enlightenment, and that requires a different kind of leadership from the ones we're seeing, both from government and from principals and leaders in the education system.
Some might argue that if you're going to look after, say, something like the emotional development of children, that that is maybe beyond the remit of a school, and that that's maybe more the remit of a family or even the broader society.
It's all of our responsibility. You know, we could put everything on parents and say, we're just going to teach kids maths, we're going to teach them science, you can do everything else. Doesn't work. It's never worked like that. So I think we have a collective social responsibility for the well-being of each other, whether it's children or seniors, people with disabilities. We all have a responsibility for that. And I agree, parents have a role here. So a school should be just as much about educating and helping parents do their job as it is about the children. But you can't teach maths to a child who's emotionally upset.
So what needs to happen then for schools to adjust to their roles to fulfil the needs that you see are currently not being filled?
I think we have to stop trying to set schools up to fail, which is what the many systems are doing. They're setting challenging standards, they're demanding outcomes and performance that don't take into account who's in that school, who the kids actually are. And so I think we have to empower schools. The only unit of measurement that matters is the school itself. So we have to let them determine what they think they can achieve based on what they have as resources, who their students are and what the skills and competence of their staff are. And they also have to develop the support of the community and the parents of that school. So the first thing is to empower and enable schools to be the focus and unit of measurement. And the second thing is to develop a sense of real striving for these children in terms of what it is that each child can do. When I was leaving school, my careers master said to me, "You'll make nothing of yourself. You'll end up filling the shelves of a supermarket store. That will be your job." So every time I wrote a book, I sent one to him with a note saying, "Did this between the jam and the sugars." And we just don't know what kids are capable of until we challenge them, until we enable them, until we equip them with the knowledge and skills that's relevant to them. So I think we need to actually do a lot more in personalizing education. I think we do a lot more about keeping the curriculum broad. This current preoccupation with science, technology, engineering and mathematics, somewhat unfortunate. One of the fastest growing businesses in the UK is called fashion. It's a 26 billion sterling industry growing at 13% per annum. Fashion is technological, but it's also historical, cultural, design-based, art-based. We need broad education to enable design industries to grow. I don't think we should be restricting curriculum. I think we should be broadening it. I think we should be personalizing it. I think we should be enabling teachers to make professional decisions collaboratively with their peers. We should get out of the way as jurisdictional leaders. We should get out of the way as governments and just stop worrying about it.
So if you're going to advocate having the school as the unit of interest, how do you then encourage a school to do their best? Or how do you know if a school could actually do better than what they're currently doing?
I was recently in Queensland, and that was one of the questions that Queensland as a government is pursuing. And their philosophy as a government is a great school for all and a great school down the street. And what they're doing is partnering different performing schools with similar catchment areas. So schools with similar kinds of kids together and challenging them to do better by working together and collaborating. So collaborative professional autonomy is more likely to produce results than diktats from some minister. So I think we need to start to trust the profession. How do we get doctors to do better? We share evidence. We get them to talk to each other. That's what we do. We show them how success works for various kinds of treatment and they adopt them. That's what teachers do. So we should start to trust the profession.
So if we take the two sides there, one is evidence. What kind of evidence would you look for in a school to know how well they're doing and to push themselves forward?
So one of the schools we're working with has a full-time in-residence researcher. And we spent a year working with the teachers, the kids, the parents, the community members that are involved with the school, local businesses, asking that exact question, what should we look at? And none of them ever mentioned PISA. None of them ever mentioned standardized tests. All of them mentioned things like, is this a safe place to be? Am I learning something new and different and advancing my learning every day? Have I got a best friend at school, both an adult and a fellow student, that I can share confidences with? When I go home, am I supported in my learning at home? So it's not about these standardized tests. Teachers make almost no difference to standardized tests. They're too busy changing kids' minds and lives. So I think we need to start looking at softer measures than these hard outcome measures that people are preoccupied with. We should stop having PISA envy.
And the other thing you mentioned about doctors is that they talk to one another.
All the time.
But schools are almost set up to discourage teachers from talking to each other.
Well, your schools maybe. We've spent a lot of time connecting our schools together. In Alberta, which is where I live and work, we have a high school revolution project going, supported and funded by government, where 200 schools are partnered together to look at ideas about what else can we do that would make a difference to learning, well-being and safety. We have schools partnered between Alberta, Ontario and Norway. We have partnerships between Alberta and Finland, which involve kids and teachers physically going to each other and spending significant amounts of time. The school we're working in as a model school has sent all of its teachers out rather than having courses. They say, find another classroom to go to somewhere in this district and spend a day in that somebody else's shoes. Just spend time in that classroom and see what they're doing. And come back and tell us what this taught you about your own teaching and what did you see that you can try and do. So there's lots of things we can do, and we're deliberately and purposefully making peer learning and peer connections for learning amongst teachers more possible rather than less.
So whose model are you following in creating these kinds of schools? Well, or if somebody wanted to read up about it?
Well, that's a good question, because we've been publishing books around this work for some time now in partnership with the Alberta Teachers Association. So the Alberta Teachers Association is both the union, but more importantly, a professional and research organization, one of the leading ones in the world. And so we've been using our partnership with them to publish. And I'm just working on a book with Simon Breakspear from Australia and Jean Stiles, who's a principal of this model school. And we'll be publishing next year on the resilient and adaptive school. And we publish on websites, we publish papers. A recent paper came out from the Alberta Teachers Association, so anybody could look at this work there.
Many people struggle with aspects of life today, individually and perhaps on a school level as well. What are you learning about resilience and where it comes from, either as a school or as an individual?
What we know is resilience is about bouncing back. It's about having a network you can use to help you find the next solution to the challenge that you're facing. It's about having a peer network that supports you. And it's about having an ability to share what's challenging you in a way that helps other people help you. At the level of the school, resilience is about bouncing back from challenge, threat, or uncertainty. A school in my district had a major fire 4 weeks before the school opened. Around about a third of the buildings of the school were gone. And the initial reaction was a complete despair. You know, we have 522 elementary school children about to show up 4 weeks from now, and we have no school for them. School opened on time, with full facilities for every child, because the community rallied round, the district rallied round, the government rallied round, more importantly, the business community rallied round. And so buildings suddenly arrived, portable buildings suddenly arrived. And actually the school is healthier now than it was before the fire. This is not an encouragement to schools to burn themselves down. But it's an example of resilience in action. That staff are the proudest staff in the district right now, because they achieved something everybody said was not possible. But that's what happens when you're running a school that's based on trust, openness, decisiveness, and a future-focused behavior.
So is resilience something then that happens when it's needed, or is it something that can actively be learned?
We've drawn a distinction between resilience as a response to threat, challenge, or change, and the building of adaptive capacity to enable that to happen. And so that you can do all the time. You can build this adaptive capacity in. And you do it by coming back to the earlier conversation of trusting staff, developing peer networks, developing evidence-based decisions, having open conversations about what else can we do to build equity, what else can we do to build success, what else can we do to enable learning. And if you have those conversations all the time, but are very deliberate about them, and you document what we've committed to and hold people accountable to what they have committed to, as opposed to what's imposed on them, then you can build this adaptive capacity, which enables this resilience to occur.
The schools that you're working with, where the unit of interest is the school itself, how do policymakers respond to that, given their interest in these PISA and TIMSS and PIRLS results?
We discourage them from getting involved, really, because they are preoccupied with the wrong things. One superintendent said to one of my principal colleagues, "When is too much innovation? Is there such a thing as too much innovation?" And her response was wonderful. She said, "I'd let you know when every one of my children graduates with honours and distinction." In other words, go away. Yes, I mean, we have too many policymakers with very little to do. So we should stop worrying about this stuff and start asking a better question. Is what else can I do to help you do what it is you need to do in your school? That's what policymakers could do. That's what governments could do. Rather than trying to impose frameworks and strategies and targets and having all its intervention strategies. You know, Britain has this, you know, if you're a failing school, then we have this team that will come in and transform your school. It's all, well, I could use a word that's inappropriate on Irish radio and television, but I think we have too many policymakers with too little to do, and it leads to very stupid things happening. The OECD reported earlier this year that of the 450 innovations they looked at since 2000, only 1 in 10 had made a difference to learning, and only 1 in 100 was evidence-based. So that's what policymakers do. They're getting in the way.
So they should give more autonomy to schools?
Absolutely. And sooner the better. And the irony is, the less they worry about PISA, the more the results will improve.
Why is that?
Well, because it's their preoccupation and meddling that's making things worse. I'll reiterate, teachers make very little difference to PISA outcomes. Schools make a lot of difference to the well-being of children. And so by not focusing on PISA, by focusing instead on the kids, by focusing upon learning, we might actually improve the way in which kids learn maths and science and literacy.
You were closely involved with the world's first online MBA.
I invented it, actually. I created it.
Why is the MBA suitable for online learning?
Well, for two reasons. One is you're creating a community of practice. So it's an executive MBA. Everybody on the program then and now is 20 years old, were middle range to senior executives. So we could create a community learning partnership that was focused on getting the adults involved in this program to share their learning with each other. So the whole design was built around communities of practice from day one. It comes back to the same thing, peer network sharing. And I redefined the purpose of our work from, we're not in the teaching business anymore, we're in the learning business. And so the platform we used is a collaborative platform. The learning design we use is one that challenges learners to share knowledge and experience and to co-create knowledge. So it's a graduate program, and we challenge graduates to create graduate-level knowledge. And a business context for that is terrific for doing that. It would be difficult to do for engineering. It would be difficult to do for some other subjects. But business, basically, which is a social science, lends itself very naturally to this kind of thing.
Why do you say it would be difficult to do for engineering?
Because there's so much work you need to do where there's a very strong instructional component. I mean, I don't want an engineer to build a bridge because they've learned to do it on YouTube. In the same way, I don't want a brain surgeon operating on me because they saw a procedure on YouTube. But business is actually a very different beast. It's much more of a social animal. And it's very similar to education. We're talking about relationships. We're talking about trust. We're talking about building products and services that people want. And so you really have to understand people in order to run businesses, whereas engineers generally don't understand people. They understand bridges and roads and structures and usage of these facilities, but they do so in terms of stress and demand. So I think there's much more technical work. We've got better at being able to teach engineering online now through the use of simulations and games, but we launched the MBA in 1994 when the internet speed was 24,000 bits per week, basically. I mean, it wasn't fast at all. So we created something quite new and different. We were the first online MBA in the world and still the largest MBA in Canada with 1,200 students right now.
And do you think education works well online?
It can. Some of your listeners will be aware the OECD just produced a report that says it's made very little difference to learning outcomes. But the learning outcomes they're looking at are PISA measures. So we may have a different problem. But actually, technology can be hugely helpful. We ran a project with young kids aged 7 and 8 with robotics that was unbelievably impressive, what the kids could do with these robotics. We challenged them to clear the snow from the roofs of people's houses, which in my part of the world is a real serious need. And these 7 and 8 year olds built robots that could do that and did so as teams. They did so through really creative solutions, using a lot of maths and science to do it. And one of these robots is now patented and is likely to appear on the market. So when 7 and 8 year olds can do that, you're teaching something.
But it must say something about the teachers as well.
It says a lot about teachers. Technology does not replace teachers. It's a support and supplement in the same way that textbooks are. So I think we should see technology as an aid for creative learning, but not as a replacement for the work of teachers.
And what do you see as the limitations then of online learning at the moment?
In schools, I think there are lots. One of them is you can't make significant use of technology without literacy and numeracy skills. And so that's one thing. I think the other thing is no amount of technology being introduced to schools with no support for the professional development of teachers. But when you see technology being used intelligently in classrooms, it can blow you away. There's a colleague of mine, Terry Godwalt, is running a project right now with 10,000 kids around the world working together on the future of the world's forests. As a collaborative project using simple technologies for collaboration, video conferencing, collaborative platforms for sharing documents, co-creating knowledge, and they're presenting their findings at the Paris Climate Change Summit. So that's what you can do with technology. It's all about the teaching, though, and there's a lot of science in that work that they have to do. There's some rigor required for this.
You've said you're a futurist, so what do you think schools will look like in 10 years' time?
In most parts of the world, they'll look exactly like they do now. I went to school in the 1950s and 60s, and I went back to my old school, which hasn't changed at all. And I taught in the 70s and early 80s in schools, and I went back to the schools I taught in, and they haven't changed at all. And I went to a brand new school recently in my own jurisdiction, which looks exactly like the one I went to in 1950. And that's about money and lack of vision and foresight. But I've been to schools in various parts of the world which are actually more like Google's headquarters than like the schools I've seen in Dublin here, because they realise that actually learning is changing dramatically and can be very, very different. You don't need classrooms in the way that we have them now. And so there's some schools I've been to in Dubai, in Singapore, in Britain, in North America, which more resemble Google or my own technology shop, which is essentially an open space with lots of spare little spaces around the edges that you can do teamwork in, with a big space in the middle for us to collaborate as a single entity. That's what the school of the future might look like. But I'm not optimistic about architects and about governments having inspirations. We're actually building schools in Canada that don't have school playgrounds, because that's a luxury. And you say, actually, no. In elementary school, it's as important as the classroom work. But you try tell this to governments preoccupied with PISA and other silly things that get in the way.
And where you see these schools that you think are models for the future, how have they come about?
They've come about largely because the collective wisdom of the staff, who got a chance to influence that design, shaped the way in which the school then appeared. There's a school in Bolton in England, just across the water, which is like Google. It's a Google-like place. And I've spent time there, and I've spent time with a lot of the staff. It's a largely Muslim community. But the staff designed that school in partnership with the kids and the parents. They had a budget. Everybody else got out of the way, and this is what they created. It's a wonderful place. And this was a school that was on the failing list in that part of the UK, is now the top-performing school in that jurisdiction.
But did they have extra money that wasn't available to other schools?
No, they had exactly the same budget they would have had for any other school building. They just used it differently. They didn't waste it on lots of things like desks, and they have big collaborative tables which are cheaper than lots of individual desks. They have lots of open space, which is cheaper than having lots of classrooms. They use the extra money to have a hot lunch program, which means the kids are actually well-fed and able to work all day. And kids come to school early and leave late because they love being there, which is not the case in the old school that they've just replaced.
You're also interested in journalism. How well do you think educational matters are covered by the media?
It's pretty obvious that the media has bought into this PISA bullshit. They've bought into this market-based stuff. They've bought into this competitiveness thing. So journalists seem to love reporting league tables and failure and so on. And it's rather like the reporting of science. It's very shallow. So with a few exceptions, I mean, there's not very good journalism about science, and there's not very good journalism about education. And so I think we have a problem in the public perception of schooling as a result of low level of journalistic coverage. Now, the other side of that is newspapers are under tremendous pressure to sell, and good news stories don't sell. People are more interested in drama than good news, so I get that. Journalism has been cut to the bone in terms of reporting. I get that. In Canada, we have just two qualified scientists working on any newspaper anywhere in the country. And so the science coverage in my local newspaper is by a guy who also does sports and whose first degree is in modern languages. And he's covering climate change. Oh, great. You know, we're going to get good evidence here. And it's the same with education. People all went to school. We all know all about education. No, we don't.
And finally, Stephen, could you say a little bit about the innovation expedition?
So this is a network of people that likes to respond to a challenge. And the challenge I've just put in front of this network is to answer the question, what's the future of youth? 30 years from now, what will be the state of play for young people in the developed and the developing world? What will their health look like? What will be their mental health? What will the educational challenges be for these young people? What are their involvements in democracy and politics and community? What's going to happen to young people and their identity? And so we're beginning a strategic foresight activity involving 15 of the network as in coordinating many other members of the network in exploring that question for an expedition that will last 2 years. And the expedition will have some inspired conversations. We'll have keynotes that will be available online. We'll have some challenge dialogue conversations. We'll have some base camps in which we'll develop scenarios for the future. And we'll involve a lot of young people in this work. We're talking about involving 100,000 young people over a 24-month period. So that's the kind of thing the network does.
So if someone wants to find out more about it?
Get in touch.
And you can get in touch with Stephen Murgatroyd at stephen.murgatroyd@shaw.ca. And that brings this week's Inside Education to an end. Thanks to Stephen Murgatroyd for his time and to Tim Hurley of Enerdelm for setting up the interview. You can listen to or download podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes on insideed.com. You can get in touch with the programme by writing to me with feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.